Harrowell, who is most recently the author of The Escape. Adam, how are you doing?
I'm very good, thank you.
First off, I wanted to talk about the narrator device that is in both The Escape and Politics. In The Escape, you have the narrator's voice start off as a friend of Hafner, almost a character. And in this capacity, The Escape shares much in common with Politics, except for, of course, the eagerness to please, the concern over, hey, I really like writing this description of Anjali's breasts and the like. And I'm curious about, number one, how this narrator device emerged and why it's a little bit more subdued, almost in a kind of l'autrement kind of way in The Escape.
It developed in Politics because the first draft of Politics actually was an entirely, in my head, was a kind of Henry James style novel. Uh-huh. It was entirely third person. And when I reread it, I realized that I myself didn't understand at all what was going on. It was so kind of involuted and delicate. So when I was rewriting, I kind of, and weirdly, there was one passage in the very first draft, which was in this kind of first person that was just me just kind of describing something. And suddenly I realized that was basically the only moment I liked in the whole book.
How much else did you write before you?
It was a whole like 50,000 word draft.
Wow. Kind
of, and so in rewriting, I then just kind of decided that I just had fun. And in Politics, this narrative voice is there almost as a kind of Pompidou Center style, let's put everything on the outside so that kind of the entire workings of this novel become visible through the narrative voice. And it partly, I think, it allows you to solve quite a few technical problems. I mean, it allows you, it's a very simple solution to any form of transition. And also, because I'm very interested in the essayistic in fiction, so it's a really nice route to kind of being able to play around with ideas without being ultra serious, and to kind of blur the boundary between what might be a general theory in the novel and kind of what the characters are doing. But partly it was also because I was really interested, and still am, I think, in what you can do to a reader and the reading experience, and how you both... I think with Politics, I think you're right, it's eager to please, but also I think it's kind of eager to annoy at the same time. There's a sort of, it's eager to, there's a lovely sentence of Lawrence Stern I like, where he talks about the power of the pen that I have over you, talking to the reader. And that kind of weird S&M of writing really intrigues me, because on the one hand, and it's very difficult to pitch, because if you are too annoying, then you're too annoying. And if but it was something that really intrigued me. And then actually, I've since found that both in writing an essay I wrote on translation, The Delighted States, and The Escape, both times I started each new book without this narrative voice, thinking, really, I should leave that there.
Really?
And both times I thought, actually, I still feel there's more I want to do with this. So with The Escape, it is different because, it's semi a character. It's almost a character in that he says, this narrator, who's essentially a version of me, that they is friends of this main character, Hafner, who's a lot older than him, but they kind of, in some way, there's some family friend. Occasionally he'll say, Hafner told him something. But really, it's a much more attenuated presence in the book. And it's true that this narrator seems a little bit older and wiser. He seems a bit less less crazy in a way. There's less kind of exhibitionism going on. But I think it was because it was trying to do something different, and I think it's that I'm only interested in kind of formal tricks if they're part of whatever subject matter you're trying to kind of open out. And I think in Politics, it was a lot to do with embarrassment, both within the characters and how you could almost embarrass a reader as well, or what was embarrassing to reveal as a writer. And that kind of rather difficult, slightly creepy, slightly gruesome kind of hinterland. In The Escape, I was much more interested in kind of what it was to talk about a character at all. It was much more about kind of why it feels kind of okay, what we mean by privacy of a character and what we mean by kind of when we describe in real life how someone has become a character. And so here, I think, I was much more interested in simply that there was a way in which this novelist narrator was claiming to be a friend, and yet equally the main subject of this novel is something that he can't possibly have known have happened.
Yeah.
And so that kind of ambiguity of, on the one hand, therefore, he must be making stuff up, and yet, on the other hand, he's claiming to have some kind of inner link to the character. That was what I was kind of interested in. And so the reason why I think they're slightly different voices is because they're slightly... The concern of what I was trying to do with this I is different. But on the other hand, in both cases, they are ways of smuggling me into the book.
But it also seems to me that with the escape narrator, he's not so much invested in the idea of, hey, you'll love this guy, as opposed to, well, I'm sort of a friend, and he's almost apologetic in some sense. And I'm curious, going back to the fact that this narrative voice didn't actually emerge over the course. And I mean, did you write an entire novel of The Escape before?
No, with The Escape it was different. With The Escape, I kind of started with when I started the novel, I had the intention that it would have none of the kind of that. I didn't really want to. I certainly didn't want to repeat the whatever kind of formal game I was doing in politics. And it was only when I realized that it was going to allow me to kind of. But it was much earlier on with politics. I'd finished the entire draft. Here it was. After about three or four chapters, I actually thought, no, this is going to be more interesting. Yeah. I can do something here using the voice, but in a different way.
Was L'Entremont a sort of an inspiration for this voice at all? Or
The French...
Bowman picked up the L'Entremont style where, like, the narrator exists to sort of introduce the reader into a rather seamy situation. In this case, at the very beginning of the book, you have him, of course, supervising this wardrobe voyeur scenario.
It's interesting because actually I've been thinking a lot about him recently, but I don't think he was there at all. I mean, he's someone I'd read before, but I think it's odd actually because I was actually thinking recently. The thing I find most interesting about L'Entremont, I think, is when what he does with, you know, his two different books, where on the one hand, the one is this gothic horror, and then the other one is this seemingly, well, partly playing with plagiarism and also incredibly moralistic book. And I quite like the kind of, if you stick them together, I think you get. Yeah, you get a proto-novel almost. So that kind of extraordinary bifurcation of voice, that does interest me for what I think I'm thinking about now. Yeah. But actually, with The Escape, no, I don't think it was sort of there.
Well, I also wanted to ask this sense of annoyance which you raised in this first answer. I'm curious if you worried that The Escape might possibly be perceived as self-indulgent. That was one of the motivating factors for toning down the narrator and saying, my hero, but not going out of your way to please, or is this a...
Self-indulgent in what way?
Well, self-indulgent in the sense of, in politics, it's like, hi, like me. And in The Escape, it's more like, well, I'm the friend, and here are these particular characters, here are their motivations, and therefore... It almost equalizes both Hefner and the narrator this time around, whereas in politics, and this is not a criticism or anything, but politics, is, that narrator voice is just as much of a character as the two in there.
I'm not sure it was about that issue so much as I was much more... I think there are similarities between politics and The Escape in their kind of ethical concerns.
Yeah.
And one of them is, and in both cases, I think, weirdly, but in different routes, they're about kind of saying, well, what if you were to be totally selfish? Is there such... Yeah. Why is it so kind of wrong to not follow your appetites or kind of... or hurt people? Is it genuinely bad to hurt someone in the pursuit of your own pleasure? And whereas in politics, it's because there are these kind of cute kids who are kind of... incapable of hurting someone else and thus create a nightmare scenario for themselves, which they think is a kind of utopia. Here you get the kind of old guy who is in fact an entirely selfish person, or seems so.
Yeah.
And so I suppose it's true that I definitely thought that one of the problems for the reader was going to be what I wanted to do was present this character who would at first seem mildly repellent, this voyeur in a wardrobe staring at kind of two strangers having sex. But that by the end of the novel, if it worked, you were going to actually feel both that he did have a coherent moral kind of structure and also was rather likable.
Yeah.
And I suppose, the game of politics was that they were likable. And so the kind of all of the exhibitionists, you're going to like these people, was because there was a sort of sense of this is about likability. Partly this was set in a kind of politics, was set in a likable world. It was set in a kind of cutesy, kind of hipsterish world. Whereas this is much more, I think, slightly, there are things about Hefner that, I suppose I myself don't like. And I wanted to create this character where I wasn't as kind of sold on the character myself. That I wanted to kind of create a kind of little machine where you would have to actually change your moral values or examine your own moral values as a reader.
So this is your worldview. With decades of experience comes decades of the capacity to hurt other people? Or?
I'm only 31.
Okay,
I think... I have no own conclusion. I'm not interested in... I think what I mean... It was kind of... I am interested in hedonism, I think, and kind of why... There seems to be kind of two levels of it. On the one hand, it seems that our society is kind of you know, the English American society, particularly Western society, is deeply devoted to sort of ideals of pleasure. But I think there's a real puritanical core, actually, to kind of a lot of the ways that we still very much value the couple, the kind of family, the kind of... There is something that's very much about that you should be altruistic and you shouldn't hurt. And in one way, I suppose, I think that's slightly immature as a moral kind of system, that you can't... There are going to be conflicts. And where politics, I think, I was interested in showing kind of some kind of self-destruction in that. Here you have someone who's almost seems to be outside those kind of moral values.
Yeah.
So no, it's not like I'm saying everyone should now go out and kind of be horribly unfaithful to everybody. And
it was a bit of a joke, you know. I just.
But on the other hand, you know, it's maybe not such a terrible thing.
I wanted to ask about the names. I mean, Goldfaden, of course, is the guy who came up with the first Yiddish opera.
Yeah.
You have, of course, Hafner, which is close to Hugh Hefner, and which is, in fact, mentioned in that book, that particular association. And I don't think it's an accident that Benji might, in fact, be construed with Walter Benjamin. Yeah, you know, the work of art in the age of mechanical reproduction, of which this does considerable reproduction. I'm curious why you were interested in using character names that were essentially lifted from popular or cultural references, and also this, you know, note at the end of the book in which you say that you quote all these various people, and digging through it, it seemed to me as if you didn't so much quote them as opposed to, I suppose, taking stories and shifting them around. At least it didn't feel like this. Either you pulled one on me. I don't think it was absolutely paraphrased or even remotely paraphrased. I was curious about why recycling of this nature occurred, both with the names and also with the so-called quotes.
Wow, that's huge. It's a kind of on the names. I think names are really odd, because there's something I think almost Freudian about it, where for what you're not always aware why a name feels right to you. I think, and I know, and Hafner actually chose. I'd always wanted to write a kind of an ambivalent character called Hafner after a boy who kind of bullied me at school was called Hafner.
Named close to Hafner.
So no, he was actually called Hafner. That was his second name. So that was when I was like 9. So obviously in some deep, but I've also actually rather liked it as a name. And then it was actually only halfway through writing the book that I suddenly thought, oh fuck, everyone is going to think this is a joke on Hefner. So actually, that's why I put the joke in, was to sort of try and diffuse
nullify
that. Nullify that one. Goldfaden, yeah, was deliberately the Yiddish dramatist. And Benji, it wasn't so much, I think, from Walter Benjamin, although I'm sure that was at the back of my, that wasn't deliberate, but I'm sure that was there unconsciously. But certainly the idea of the biblical younger son and the kind of, so, and I think that with the names, with the very Jewish names like Goldfaden, that was because I was very interested in almost doing a caricatural Jewishness, or a particular type of sort of East European Jewishness, of immigrant Jewishness, because one of the things that this novel, I think, is in dialogue with, and what Hafner, the character, is in dialogue with, is a particular version of Jewishness. And so that's a kind of another... So I think the Jewish names are kind of... They were there as deliberate East European sort of... there was a kind of air of competition. I mean, the other source, actually, of the names that I'd completely forgotten about, but I only remembered when recently I saw this film again, To Be or Not to Be, Ernst Lubitsch's To Be or Not to Be. And for some reason, I'd seen it quite early on when I was writing this book, and I mean, just before I started the book, and I had a kind of cast list from the some handout that I'd got. And so a lot of the names are actually from... like Tummel, Frau Tummel, is taken from someone who was like the production manager on To Be or Not to Be. But definitely the names come from this locus of sort of Central Europe.
Yeah.
And it's true. And I suppose that leads to the kind of the quotations, because there was a way in which I was definitely interested in doing a kind of miniature recapitulation in this book of kind of my entire literary past.
Yeah.
I think slightly to then move away from it, to kind of finish with it, and then so that hopefully... I don't know if it's, you know, that what I then write would be kind of freer or something completely different. And it was thematically, really, though, it was because I think, although, I mean, the real concern of this book, I think, is something to do with immaturity and a defense of immaturity, even, but through the prism of really not being able to tell the difference between the past and the future, between the past and the present, sorry. So, in this character who is constantly lapsing into flashbacks, so that sometimes a character is, he's suddenly in a conversation from 30 years ago, And really the joke of the book and also the seriousness of the book is the idea that no one ever grows up, that you're the same person you were, and that therefore the concerns of a 30-year-old might be the same as the concerns of a 78-year-old. Yeah. And similarly, that 78-year-old will have no different concerns to those he had throughout his life. And so similarly, this kind of appropriation that I wanted to do in this, in the narrative voice, in the structure of the prose, was a similar way that you would have this weird ghostly sensation, hopefully, that suddenly you were reading kind of either from something absolutely ancient like Suetonius's Lives of the Caesars or Mel Brooks or kind of, I don't know, anything, you know, or kind of suddenly kind of Khlebnikov, the kind of Russian futurist poet, so that there would be the, but the borrowings would be minuscule. So they would often be hardly noticeable to the kind of reader as they were going along. And the point would be a kind of game with how much of my prose could take everyone else's prose, if you see what I mean. How much could it be disguised, I suppose, was my interest. Would these things stand out? Or would actually you get to the end of the novel and think, where the fuck was Khlebnikov in that? Where was Kavafi? Where was, you know... and certainly I also kind of changed a bit. I mean, actually, because I've just come from Italy where... doing promotion for the book, and where someone sort of sat me down and said, all right, well, can you give me an example of one of these quotations? And I just opened it at random, and it was towards the end where there's a line where something like, the reticulate stars were nets hauling in Hafner. And this is right at the end of the novel, which I think I definitely imagined as both his kind of almost a death. It was within the kind of actual novel, even though he wasn't dying, but kind of within the sort of structure of the book, it was his death, but it was also his apotheosis. And actually this quote, though, so, and in Khlebnikov, there is simply an image of the stars looking like nets. That's, yeah. And so I've sort of added this. I mean, so it's both Khlebnikov's image, but also it's then made my own within the kind of structure of the book. There's no kind of idea of hauling someone up.
Yeah.
So the apotheosis is all mine, even though the initial image is all Khlebnikov's.
Yeah.
And so that was the sort of thing I wanted, so that it was never just a straight...
Plucking.
And also that it was completely unimportant. It was certainly not so that people would pride themselves on thinking, oh, there's kind of whoever. It was not at all a kind of, so that people could then think, oh, fantastic, I've recognised the source, because actually recognising the source is irrelevant. You know?
Judging by the zeal in your eyes, it seems to me that really the pleasure you had in writing this novel, and correct me if I'm wrong, had much to do with plucking something and completely... distorting it in such a way as to make it yours. That this, and this, if this is true, and you can please shout me down if I'm wrong, this is a much different focus, I suppose, than politics, which was more about, I suppose, capturing whatever was around you with which to actually pour it into the book. Is this just fair to say that?
It's true that I think certainly, I mean, both of them, I mean, I'm really into collage as a kind of novelistic form, And in both, there are collage elements, and they're slightly differently arranged, so that in politics, it's very obvious where the beginning in it, so that suddenly I'll have Stalin on the phone, and that will be a different section to the kind of section of kids having sex in North London. Whereas here, the past is much more sort of infiltrated into the rest of the book.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't want to get... It's certainly not true that I was sat there with kind of, you know, 96... the quotations, a lot of them were just things that came to me in my head as I was kind of writing. They certainly weren't... There was no program of any particular quote I needed to get in, or kind of. It was more that I decided to give free rein to that slightly elusive. There's that bit in my brain that is like hopelessly with a hopelessly good memory, so that kind of it's a terrible affliction. So that, you know, if anything occurred to me, I did. Whereas in politics, I might have kept it out. It's true. Here, I did want to put it in. I suppose I wouldn't want to see the. It's true that I think politics is very much a kind of. It was of its moment for me and kind of for kind of, I think, the readers. It described a very particular thing that was kind of going on, I think, in sort of the ways people were thinking nearly 10 years ago now. And I still think there's something true about, you know, the escape. It's just partly because the other important character is this grandson who is actually kind of slightly younger than me, actually, in the book, but basically kind of another version of me or something that I could have been, I think. And also because, I suppose, again, I don't believe that just because you write about someone old, you're therefore not writing about you.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this also, I mean, I bring this up because there's one moment where Zinka is sitting there and she's watching a television and there's a baseball player on there. And she immediately thinks, oh, he's going to say, this is where the magic happens. And then, of course, right as she thinks it, the ball player says, this is where the magic happens. And this was a really interesting moment to me because it almost suggested one of the themes of the book, at least to me anyway, was one in which, well, how can you offer anything original when you know it's going to be perpetuated by the mass media or the mass culture around you. And this is intriguing also because here you've set this book in the tail end of the 20th century, or roughly around 2000 or whatnot, and we're essentially 10 years early before it becomes worse. And so I'm curious about this predicament. In fact, in The Delighted States, you in fact define magic very helpfully. I looked this up, where something happens which seems to be miraculous, but which has a simple, rational, and human explanation, which is extremely apropos to this dilemma. And I'm curious how much this was of concern for you, or whether this may have motivated some of the permutation of quotes, whether you change things with which to make them distinct or original or whatnot.
I don't know. I hadn't thought. It's true that I had not at all noticed that motif does fit. It's true, and it's certainly true that I liked that moment of. And it, I think I used it because I think it literally happened to me that I was kind of sitting in some hotel room watching kind of that MTV Cribs program, and kind of thinking he's going to say this, and then being filled with joy when he did. And I suppose that, in a way, I'm just thinking kind of now. On the one hand, the reason it gives you such joy when a moment like that happens is actually it's not that normal for, you know, that, although there is such predictability in popular culture, actually for it to be that predictable is joyful because it's not that normal. If it was that normal, it'd be terrifying.
Yeah.
So there's a way in which I think one should step back from kind of totally saying we live in a total era of kind of appropriation and repetition, because I think that's just not true. You know, that there's still such a thing as style, and style seems to me singularity. Within the context of the book, within the escape, it's true, though, that there is this motif of kind of that the same things are happening and things are predictable. But again, actually, I suppose what I'm interested in is that in the machine that is the plot of this book, it actually ends up with things being completely inverted and out of certainly what Hafner thinks of as normal. So that actually by the end of the book, he's completely adrift out of anything that he thought was what was meant to happen. But yeah, it's true that I don't think you can be a novelist now and not be aware of the vast mass of popular culture that is both swamping you as a person and swamping everybody, and certainly making reading a more difficult thing. And so I suppose, yeah, that concern is certainly in the escape. And deliberately, I did want to make this almost a historical novel, that it wasn't about 2010, it was about 1999.
Yeah.
And that was partly, I suppose, for European reasons as well, which was that I wanted this Zinka character to be also to have had her own war. I suppose now I could have used Iraq, I suppose, but like kind of I wanted this kind of idea that there were still European wars going on, and so she's a kind of refugee from the Serbian kind of disaster, just as Hafner is a refugee from the Second World War in some ways. And so I needed everyone to have their war story. So that was partly why I needed it to be set back.
So that was, it was really more character timeline that was the more pressing concern, rather than some sort of meditation on the 20th century.
No, I did want it to be a kind of resume of the 20th century, definitely. I wanted it to be a kind of summary. And partly, I think, I suppose, because I felt, and it goes back to this idea of recapitulation, that I wanted a novel that felt like a coda. You know, that I kind of, for a moment, I wanted to call it epilogue. I thought that was just so downbeat that... But there is a way in which kind of this whole novel constitutes an epilogue to something, which in a way, partly some to Hafner's life, but also I think to the 20th century, that all of its politics, all of its kind of ideas of liberation, I think are slightly kind of destroyed in this book.
It's interesting you mention this, because I'm also going back to The Delighted States, or Miss Herbert in the UK. There's a moment where you point to Gertrude Stein's belief that the methods of the 20th century were in advance of those used in the 19th century. Can the same be said, I suppose, through this novel of the 21st in relation to the 20th?
Oh, God. Yeah. I mean, I like the Gertrude Stein. I mean, I love Gertrude Stein in general, but I like that particular moment because I love the brashness of it. I love her deeply unacademic, you know, you're taught so much that there's no such thing as progress in literature. And I like her idea that, quite frankly, actually, the 20th century was in advance. And I think that, but on the other hand, I don't know if we know what the methods of the 21st century are. I wouldn't say there was an obvious... I wouldn't say that there's an obvious kind of technique that is common to many novelists, or... There might be a tone, I think. There's a kind of... But I don't think it's at all obvious what would be the methods of the 21st century yet. It's still far too early to tell. And whether I really deep down believe that the methods of the 20th century even are in advance, I don't know. I think it's probably true that simply in terms of the history of the novel, I think it's true that for me the 19th century novel doesn't really feature in my kind of... I much more like either much earlier novels or kind of the 20th century, 21st century. And so there's a sort of... There is a fight against a certain 19th century idea of how to portray a character, what kind of detail would be in portraying a character. And what you're allowed to do with the narrative voice, I suppose, goes back to that. Why should the narrative voice be kind of hidden away? Why should this omniscient narrator be allowed to kind of not speak in the first person? But actually, in many ways, so with The Escape, though, in terms of its technique, there is a way in which it's slightly... I do think it's more subdued than Politics, and it was a kind of... I think it was a resume of kind of what I thought what the 20th century literature I loved had done. And maybe in a way now, certainly having finished it, I definitely feel I like it very much, but that now I would certainly want to do something very different. What that would be, I don't know, but...
I want to marry what you just said about the 21st century novel not having a distinct identity with what you were saying earlier about style almost being the one distinct thing we still have to defy all cultural appropriation, to defy all sampling, to defy everything. Might one say that perhaps this is where the identity of the 21st century novel is going to emerge from, this notion of retinkering? And to what degree does your own writing now, in the present, have much in common with this notion?
I definitely think that kind of appropriation is beginning to get more common. I mean, I suppose we were just mentioning Reality Hunger, yeah, which obviously talks about this quite a lot. And it's true that in another British writer I like a lot, Jeff Dyer, he's very interested in that. And there is a sort of... There are a few writers who are kind of intrigued, I think, definitely by blurring that kind of boundary between what's yours and what's not yours, and also different genres, I suppose. But again, I suppose my historical sense tells me that's been going on since Cervantes, you know, that like I don't see how anything I've just described is something that's particularly new. And I suppose also like the deep need for singularity means that you can't really make these generalizations. You know, that the idea of a 21st century novel, to me, slightly is a contradiction in terms. You know, that there are just novelists and almost there are just novels, because there are... I mean, one of the things that I think I'm always interested in is how a certain novel might not even resemble a novelist's style. You know, that they might actually be writing a novel that's not really them. Yeah. And that's the thing that's very weird to think of as a novelist, but I can see it when I'm kind of as a reader. I mean, actually, I was just thinking about this because I was just on the kind of subject of translation. I was thinking about Barbara Wright, the translator of a lot of French fiction. And then I was reading the introduction she writes, where she translates a Beckett play, Eleutheria. I don't know how you pronounce it, Eleutheria, which he'd written in French long before he'd written almost anything else, a very early play. He'd never translated himself. And then after his death, it was decided to translate it into English. And so she has this problem of how do you translate a thing when he was such a great translator of his own work. So therefore he creates the Beckettian through his own self-translations, what we think of as Beckettian style. And yet a lot of what became Beckettian style didn't exist in his style at that point because it was very early, and so he'd barely become Beckett. So on the one hand, she couldn't kind of... If she were to translate without at all thinking about what he later did, that would be wrong. And yet equally... if she were to translate totally using words that he then made his own, or kind of syntax that he made his own when it wasn't actually there. And it was just made me think that it's true that there's this basic problem of a chronology of a style, that however singular, Beckett is a great example of someone who you read one sentence by Beckett and you know it's Beckett.
Yeah.
And yet this thing is actually not Beckettian. And so how would you pastiche or imitate the Beckettian of a work that isn't Beckettian? That's a digression, but
digressions are welcome here.
but it's so back to appropriation. It does interest me, certainly, or certainly did in The Escape. One of, I think, the reasons as well is that I do feel that there's a way in which our culture is obsessed by the present moment. That it kind of it's quite terrified of the past, I think, in many ways. That kind of knowledge,
even the recent past.
Yeah. And it's partly, I think, why conspiracy theories are so kind of rife, actually, is because basically they thrive on people not knowing much about the past. You know, if you know loads about the past, then you have a depth of detail, which means that you don't get kind of seduced by that kind of idea. But actually, I think if you know, if you find out three facts, then suddenly they seem incredibly linked. And that's when you get a kind of terror of kind of hidden power and crankiness.
Have you paid attention to our Tea Party movement here in the States?
A little bit. Yeah. That's, I don't know if that's a conspiracy.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's a very fascinating nightmare.
But it is a particularly American phenomenon, I think, often as well. Well, not totally. But and I do feel that it's therefore difficult to know what you do with appropriation, because I think there's a danger that you either look like you're kind of showing off in some arid way, that this is kind of just academic knowledge. And if it's not that, then I think you have to have a very good reason for why you're doing it. And also, I think that you have to kind of make it your own. But then let's go back to someone like T.S. Eliot saying, you know, good poets change what they steal. If all you do is you just borrow something and it's no better than where it was before, then you don't deserve to have it.
Well, it could be Eliot, it could be Picasso, because there's so many people who have said that, we don't know who said it first. So there you go.
No, I mean, and it's an obvious truth that there's so much that's stolen. I mean, it's even just stolen from the conversations of your friends. You know, someone makes a good joke and I'm stealing that quite happily. And I think that, I do think there is an interest, obviously, in informal experimentation at the moment, more than maybe, say, 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah.
And a particular type of experimentation which uses different genres. And why that should be, I don't know. I'm not totally convinced by the David Shields argument that it's kind of some kind of new love of the real, because I think that that's why you do any form of art, is the real. And I don't see any contradiction between style and the real. You know, I think it's a slightly kind of naive idea to think that huge chunks of reportage or something make something more real than a novel. He obviously has problems with the form of a novel in some way.
Maybe what we're really talking about here is that we're becoming more comfortable about a truth that has been there as long as the novel has been in existence, this plucking from reality or from truth around us. Maybe that's really what's going on.
And I think also, I mean, I'm interested in certain, using this, why I can't seem to put down this kind of version of me in every book, is I think because this kind of idea of what is true and what is not, and what you're allowed to say, and what you know, what would be allowable to say in your own person, what suddenly, I mean, it's really interesting when you do readings, actually, if you write essayistically, which is something that had never occurred to me until I suddenly was doing it, where with politics, I remember there is a line where the narrator of this book sort of says, it's some line like, the next event in this story is a blowjob. I have to admit, you know, I'm very rarely averse to a blowjob. This struck me as incredibly witty in the privacy of my kind of room. You know, when you're actually reading this to kind of 500 people, and everyone is thinking, "Oh, right," you know, I was mortified. I mean, I just could barely, and I'd completely forgotten as I'd chosen this bit to read. I hadn't remembered that sentence was there, and the kind of suddenly what I spoke. And it's interesting that, you know, because the word that occurs to me is I couldn't escape. You know, that kind of literally, suddenly everyone was going to think that narrative voice, which up till that point had seemed a playful version that everyone sophisticatedly knew they couldn't identify with me, and yet as soon as there was that sentence, there was some kind of energy in the room where everyone was just thinking, "Fine, you know, that you've just said something about yourself," and that identification was terrifying. It was, and yet I think that's why I like doing it, is because I think it's a really duplicitous thing to do, because it always gives you the ability to run away.
Yeah.
And I can see what, and as a reader, I think it is a frustrating thing to do to a reader, because it's really teasing them.
On the other hand, if you're talking about saying, "Hey, I really like a blowjob in front of a crowd," versus 30 years from now, we may be talking about blowjobs in the same way that we presently talk about kissing. You know, I mean.
No,
there's also that.
It's
problem.
It's not so much. I don't even mean it was particularly embarrassing. It was more just sort of that it was obvious that I was admitting something definitely true about my sexual kind of, you know, and it wasn't even, you know, it's hardly like controversial.
Yeah.
It was just even, it felt like some kind of boundary had been crossed, that you're not meant to talk about anything that private anyway, you know, maybe with your friends, but you know, the outside. And I think that was one of the things that I was though interested in, was the register that you're allowed with a reader. And why is it that we sort of feel some things are sayable and some things are not? And I suppose with the moral judgments in The Escape, actually, I think a lot of the time I was interested in, sometimes when this narrative voice is defending Hafner, especially at his kind of seemingly worst, it was deliberate. It was almost, it's the same kind of space that's being explored there of this thing seems a little bit unsayable that I'm describing. I don't know, sort of a Jewish character who's mildly anti-Semitic or something, and this might seem a bit horrible, but actually I'm going to say I rather praise this and rather love them, you know. So I think degrees of intimacy is what interests me in kind of the sort of infinite tiny gap that there always is between reader and writer. And that links in my head to the appropriation, because it links to what is kind of real and what you can sort of steal and make your own.
Yeah. Well, to jump off this point of appropriation and style, I actually wanted to talk about what some of the unusual terms you use in the book. For example, you know, you call the 1925 crash, which we commonly know as the world crash, the universal crash. Benji, his emotions were distractedly doodled with shyness. Also with Benji, with his koala still perched on a branch of his mind. This interesting, elegant style, I must ask you about, is this really the only way, I suppose, to really gravitate towards something that is original, that is true, that is yours? What beckons this this concern of yours with elegance like this?
Oh, God. Deep neurosis, you know, a fear of mess. Well, I mean, I do think, actually, I'm not entirely joking. I think that there are very, I think with all stylists, there's a kind of, the people who make a kind of great drama of style, I think there is definitely some kind of neurotic drama going on behind that.
Yeah.
Exactly what it is, I don't know. That there's certainly an idea of desperation for sort of singularity as opposed to repetition and sameness.
Yeah.
And again, I suppose, but also I suppose I do believe that all style is trying to be more precise. So yeah, I mean, like if you take that koala, so it's like this kind of, it starts in a metaphor, then it becomes real in someone's thoughts, that they're remembering a real stuffed koala that belongs to this character. And then I suppose in a way, you know, and I think all it really, what that image is quite a true thing of that you can be, you'll have had a thought as you walk in a door, and it will take 3 seconds for that to totally fade as you join in the new conversation.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's deliberately slightly show-offy in one sense, because it's, but equally, it's only describing something very banal. And I quite like, I think, things in prose, which, it seems to me prose is a very good medium for both disturbing the reader, for because you have so much control that, it's, especially with metaphor, it's very easy to kind of wrong-foot them.
Yeah.
And I think that, so to sort of make a live koala actually a metaphorical koala that then becomes a kind of a psychological koala or something, yeah, that seems to be something that actually only prose can really do. Cinema couldn't do it, or incredibly, yeah, clumsily. You know, that's something that always interests me, is just the effects that are particular to sentences.
So your interest in an elegant flash is essentially supposed to mirror elegant flashes within consciousness, you would say?
I'm trying to think about this word elegance, though, because actually I think the other thing I'm really interested in is describing total mess as well.
Yeah.
You know, like, I don't know, fisting or something, yeah, suddenly kind of, you know, with slathers of KY jelly. There are ways in which I think, I like the contrast, I think, often between, yeah, a style that seems to try to contain everything, but which is trying to contain something potentially kind of drastic and huge. And in fact, I like it when it slightly loses its elegance sometimes, so that when you get kind of MTV in kind of, or, I mean, I'm thinking, what I really think is most particular actually to my style is not really to do with imagery, but it's to do with rhythm. That I think I have a very strange rhythm to set, that I use a huge amount of short sentences.
Yeah.
So there's often a very staccato kind of way of constructing something, which, and that's often what actually strikes me whenever I'm kind of doing a reading or something, or it often strikes me that that's almost the thing that is oddest about the way I write, is this kind of real distaste for passives as well. I hate using any passive construction.
Yeah.
And so it's very difficult to know, really. I don't think you could ever really, the irony of style, I think, is if you were to set out to be original, I don't see how that would work. You know, that I think a lot of originality is fluke. And sometimes it goes back to what I started saying at the beginning, it comes from subject matter. So I think that the originality of politics was not just, it wasn't so much the narrative voice and way of constructing a novel as the game with frankness, that it was extraordinarily exhibitionistly frank.
Yeah.
And that was because I had discovered this area of kind of experience. It seems to me the way that people in my generation were having sex, which was both incredibly free and incredibly sort of worried, and a way of talking about sex that seemed to me not described before. So it was almost the discovery of a new thing leads to the new style, rather than if I'd sat down and thought, can I develop some strange faux naive game playing voice, you know, it would have, there would have been nothing there to, it only works if there's something there to play with.
This leads me to ask you, when you're sitting there at, with the blank screen, I presume, you are having to take from whatever your subconscious is going to put onto the screen. So the question is, at what point does style enter the equation? I mean, if you have to get something like a sexual experience or an uncomfortable subject, you have to get that out, and then you have to rearrange that perhaps at some later point, or what's what is, how does it work for you exactly?
I think for me, I'm a huge rewriter.
Yeah.
So I think often I don't write, I think I'm strange in that I do write quite assiduously, but often once I'm in a novel, I write very assiduously, but actually I can go quite a long time doing pretty much nothing. And it is because I do have a fear of repeating myself, so I don't want to kind of write something that basically is immediately recognisable as something that I've, similar to something I've done before. And also, I think because I do want to wait to see until I've become obsessed by something and trust that whatever it is that's obsessing me is what I'll go for. And often it's sometimes just an image or a scene or kind of, so the escape started with this, a guy in a wardrobe watching somebody. And I wanted to make that likable. That was my interest, was kind of, I just had this kind of almost cliched farcical scene, because I think I'm always interested in farce, and wanted to try and make it ordinary. That was the kind of, and then a lot of, and then really that's how it all kind of started. And so I think what I tend to do is therefore write relatively kind of raggedly, and then try and find if there was something interesting in the way it came out, and then kind of, so I suppose what I was describing with politics of this tiny paragraph where I was talking as myself, for coming from nowhere, and then realizing that that was the thing that most interested me. And actually, similarly, there were very few, although in politics and to a certain degree The Escape are both obsessed with the sex scene. In politics, there was only one sex scene, which was what then became the first scene in the book. Yeah. But again, it was simply because for some reason I felt that had an energy, and therefore I wanted to use it, and therefore I then rewrote it and kind of redid it. But at the time, it was just there. I wasn't really kind of, I certainly wasn't sitting down to kind of, with a planned idea of sex scenes and kind of whatever.
And yet there's the Dallas proverb in this book, the history of the novel. I'm sorry. Every time you find yourself not thinking about sex, it's your mind.
That well, that's a wandering. Great example of appropriation, because that's not mine. It was Ed White. That was Ed White who I met, and just told me that while I was writing the book. So then you just think, fine, that can go in. You know, that's brilliant. I mean, the other thing I think about style and form and content is that I think I have slightly not changed my mind, but I think in The Delighted States, I think I was kind of confident that these two things just were one. And I'm now more and more thinking that actually there's a much more loose fit, that there is this horrible, they never quite go together. And sometimes you might have got a style which doesn't quite work with whatever content. I think a lot of the time it will be a fluke if you've really got, if this magical thing where form and content become the same thing, if that's the ideal. Actually, I think I was more confident of that happening kind of more often. And I think now I think it is more ragged, actually.
The pithy maxim, I'm curious where this came from, to be bohemian, you had to be an absolute insider. Yours or someone else's?
No, that's me.
That is you.
Yeah,
okay.
Finally, we've got something
that's me. Yeah, I had a feeling. Well, I'm wondering if this is your way of declaring Hafner sort of an absolute insider, or perhaps a bohemian legend in his own mind. You know, that one can only access the text largely through his particular consciousness, and then yet we're removed because the narrator is that sort of middleman. And so you have the prism between the author and the reader, and now you have this extra prism between Hafner and the narrator. So it's almost as if you have to constantly filtrate what the hell's going on here through two little tubes.
So the game with this kind of bohemian is also going on in the structure of the novel.
Or whether it's even possible to even be an absolute insider in light of this structure.
Yeah, and I think, no, I suppose, is what deep down I believe, or what I wanted, I definitely wanted that each time, in terms of the novel, as a reader, each time you thought you'd got somewhere, you found out something else from the past that actually kind of wrong-footed you. And so one of the kind of, I definitely had this image of almost kind of two lines going in opposite directions, where the kind of farcical structure of the kind of the present moment of the book, of this guy kind of chasing after women in a kind of in his old age, was matched by the kind of the backwards line of as you discovered more and more about the actual marriage that had marked him and why he's there, and you realise that this marriage actually doesn't at all look it, what it looks like and what it actually was are kind of two completely different things. And in terms of kind of Hafner as a character, yeah, I suppose the same idea was that the more you want, if you really wanted to not belong, you could only do that by having first kind of got to the absolute center. I mean, it's like there's a sort of, I don't know whether the cliche of, you know, you can only be a proper blasphemer if you were a believer first, you know, that someone who's never believed, it's irrelevant whether or not, you know, you can't blaspheme. And that, I suppose, links to something that I'm always interested in, something that immediately becomes its opposite. So I think in The Escape, I was interested as well in how kind of this motif of the emperors, of decadence and the classical. And there's some line, I think, where sort of Hafner suddenly thinks, actually, the decadent and the classical are the same thing. They lead, the classical is the decadent. You can't separate them off.
The Caligula scenario.
Yeah. And so kind of, and I think similarly, that's what I suppose I feel about, yeah, that the bohemia insider thing is the same thing, that you can't be bohemian unless you're absolutely at the center of something. Otherwise, you're just lost.
But on the other hand, you've chosen Lives of the Caesars, with which Hafner grips on to the classics.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, depending upon the historian you talk with, some people are going to say, oh, well, this is a great primary source, and other people are going to say, oh, that's a load of gossip. It's interesting to me that Hafner latches on to the Caligula, to this notion of almost braggadocio, instead of, you know, something pertinent, that this is his root, so to speak, in his own classical.
Yeah, it's true that he's not reading kind of Livy on the Republic, I suppose. So he's not reading the kind of drier. I suppose everyone chooses the classics that they want. But I suppose there's deliberately, you know, he's an autodidact. He's not some kind of great classical scholar. He's someone who's reading this stuff towards the end of his life, kind of having just about discovered it. And I think that is definitely true to. I think that the certainly, if you look at, I don't know, those series like Rome or something, the popular idea of the classic, not of the classics as an academic subject, but of the classical, is always of these kind of crazy stories of kind of extraordinary excess.
Yeah.
Even things like the gladiators and kind of Christians being thrown to lions, these are kind of incredibly cruel, and this is why we like them, actually, is the real cartoon violence of these stories. So whether or not, I'm not interested in the true classical, I mean, as in kind of, it's certainly not it would be unfair to start saying, but actually, look, the classical is a kind of, obviously it is a far wider thing than what Hafner is kind of making it out to be.
But yet the reader reading your book might also be drawn to the greatest juicy bits instead of the actual pertinent pith
I mean, but this is because, I wanted the Lives of the Caesars as a motif because partly this was a life of a Caesar as well. And it was deliberately, again, a thing where you didn't know whether you were getting the salacious gossip.
Yeah.
And some of it is salacious gossip, or the real truth. I mean, so one of the bits I kind of like the most, I think, a tiny moment, is when very early on in a list of some of Hafner's kind of deprivations, you get this story that he's given away his Mercedes to some woman, he's given away his car. And then later on, Benji actually asks him about this, and Hafner denies it. And so I loved the idea of either that's Hafner lying to his grandson, or actually maybe it's totally true that he's just saying, no, that never happened. And so that you suddenly think, so this is a story, though, that his grandson has believed about him. And that line between, within the novel, of what was fictional and what was real, and that which would then cast doubt on pretty much everything this narrator is saying. So I wanted, it goes back to what we were talking about, that here, unlike in politics, I think the narrator is almost pure, that like he's not a character in the sense of having, there's no motivation to the narrator in politics apart from to be talking to the reader. The motivation is all on the level of the reader. There's no particular angst going on, whereas I think in The Escape I did want you to sort of have to question what this narrator was doing and even narrating this story at all. Why was he kind of claiming that being unfaithful was so good? I mean, you know, I didn't want some pat kind of idea that therefore this narrator is himself an unfaithful kind of bastard, but I wanted you to think there was something at stake for the narrator.
Well, there certainly is, because there's one moment where the narrator says, if Hafner were only allowed to exist in one sentence, it would be this. He was a desire that had outlived its usefulness. And so, as a result, one says, well, why the hell am I reading this book? Because if it's all so one pithy maxim, are you suggesting maybe that, you know, in light of the fact that Hafner at one point cries out, let me be my own author, only to find that, some problematic resolution of that, because that comes right before this particular sentiment.
If you can talk about this. I mean, I think to me it was because a lot of the novel was written with the end in view of this moment when almost he kind of fades out of the picture. Mm-hmm. And it was really seen, and I definitely, it was a deep desire to disappear, I think, both on the part of this character, and I think I'm sure in a way the escape in this novel belongs to me, as it belongs to the narrator. It's about, can you ever disappear? Like, what would that mean? And can you escape from what other people think of you? You know, that kind of the sort of, at what point can you ever be? I suppose it goes back to what we're talking about of what is originality. Can you ever be anything other than a collection of other people's stories? What is the kind of point of your rich inner life that only you know about is pointless. It's the tree falling kind of on it without anyone hearing. That was really why I was right. And so that's a kind of emotional kind of reason of what you're trying to explore. And then equally though, as I say that, I'm thinking, but there is another appropriation going on, which is there are two texts that were the real ones at the back of this, which one of them was Nabokov's Pnin. And the other one, which is at the back of Nabokov's, is Eugene Onegin by Pushkin, in both of which you have this narrator who isn't massive, but who is characterized, in Eugene Onegin, it's characterized as Pushkin, who says, you know, this is a friend of mine. And in Pnin, it's slightly darker, where you're not sure what the real relation is between the narrator and Pnin himself. Yeah. There's something quite nasty going on.
Yeah.
But in both cases, these are portraits of incredibly gentle, I think, people, in Eugene Onegin and Pnin, but filtered through something which is less trustable and less gentle. And something almost seedy, I think, about the way that you write a story about anybody, you know, anything, like kind of. I suppose also I think there's a kind of trend to say now it's immoral to have too much knowledge of a character. I think I've kind of, James Wood talks about this somewhere in one of his New Yorker pieces, of kind of, that there's an admiration for a kind of narrative voice that doesn't delve too, that doesn't presume to know too much, because in real life we don't know much about other people. And Christopher Ricks has this as well. And I've always felt that in some way, though, there's a real sentimentality to that, because it's not the same as a real person, precisely because you have made this person up. So you have absolute, total access to this. This character only exists in the sentences that are there. And yet the paradox is that a sentence in itself, it's not true that a character is purely the words that exist, because there are inferences, interpolations, there are everything the reader brings. So there is depth, weirdly, to this seeming pure surface.
So by layering the escape with this style, and also with numerous twins, and also with this narrator within a narrator almost, I mean, if we look outward, you've essentially nullified any need for this James Woodian pursuit of realism or of...
Well, I suppose I'd say it makes it more realistic.
Yeah.
I mean, I think if there is a kind of postmodernism in this book, it only intrigues me to use it if it's to make something more real. Mm-hmm. And so almost, I suppose, I got to the point, I mean, which actually the narrator says at the end of this book, is almost that the more real kind of Hafner becomes, the more he disappears.
Yeah.
And actually, I sort of believe...
And the more real the narrator's voice becomes, too.
Yeah, exactly. And that kind of seems to me to be where I sort of ended up at the end of that novel, and it wasn't entirely where I thought I would get to, but it felt right, you know, it felt like actually that's something that's slightly true, that kind of, this doesn't have to be a kind of neat paradox, it's something that's just true, that... a character can acquire depth and at the same time totally elude you. You know, there doesn't have to be a sort of either or. But it's very, you know, but the kind of roots of this, I don't know. I mean, yeah. They must be scarily psychoanalytic.
Well, on that very fun, ambiguous note, Adam, thanks so much for taking the time. It was a pleasure.
Not at all. Thank you very much.
Great. Thanks. I was tired of my lady. We'd been together too long. Like a worn out recording.